This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history, and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the History of Persia. I'm Trevor Cully, and this is episode 129, Chaos in the Upper Satrapies. Last time, we started the Second War of the Diadochoi, and finished the western half of the conflict. Upon Antipater's death, the regency of Macedon passed to the elder statesman Polypherkon, which outraged Antipater's own son, Cassander. Cassander thus allied with Ptolemy, Lysander, and Antigonus Monophthalmos to seize power for himself. Lysander briefly joined the war to help clean up after finishing his own conflicts in Thrace. Ptolemy managed to miraculously avoid any direct conflict after annexing most of Syria, Palestine, and Phoenicia into the Egyptian satrapy. Cassander successfully drove Polypherkon's forces back into a pair of last stands and seized power after Queen Eurydice, wife of Philip III Aridaeus, chose Cassander's side. Unfortunately for her, this only came after Eurydice was betrayed by her own men, who sided with the queen grandmother Olympias. Olympias had Philip and Eurydice executed. Cassander had Olympias killed in turn. And thus, the new regent was now the sole authority on behalf of the child king Alexander IV. However, while all of that was happening, the war expanded rapidly in the east. At the outset of the conflict, Polypherkon restored Eumenes of Cardia to good standing in the empire in exchange for the former secretary to Alexander the Great's help in fighting Antigonus. Eumenes raised an army in the name of a deified Alexander and raided Phoenicia before marching east, into Mesopotamia, with Antigonus hot on his heels. Now, at long last, all is right with the world. I posted a version of this on Twitter a week or two ago, but these last few episodes were actually much harder for me to write than normal. Call it a sustained hyperfixation, personal bias, or whatever you want, but ancient history is much less interesting to me when it is focused west of the Euphrates River, even when it is fundamentally a story about the exact same people fighting in the exact same war. But no more. In 317 BCE, Eumenes and his army crossed the river and settled in for winter quarters in the villages surrounding a city known in Greek as Carhai. This is actually a city we've seen several times before. Carhai is just Haran, the same place where the last kings of the Neo-Assyrian Empire made their stand against Babylon, and the birthplace of the last independent Babylonian king, Nabonidus. Technically, the H in Haran is that fricative sound seen in a lot of Semitic words like Hanukkah. So the city became better known as Carhai for a few centuries. Eumenes sent letters to the most powerful eastern satraps in Media and Babylon, Pathon and Seleucus, asking for their aid against Antigonus. Seleucus said that he would happily follow the two kings of Macedon and their rightfully appointed regent, meaning Polypharchon. But he also said that he would, under no circumstances, assist Eumenes, who had been condemned to death before Antipater died. Pathon agreed with Seleucus, and the two eastern satraps sent a letter to Antigonus, the commander of the Silver Shields and one of the most senior officers in Eumenes' company. The satraps of Babylon and Media wanted Antigonus to detain or execute his commanding officer. Only then would the other two support the war against Antigonus. The Silver Shields ignored this request and continued supporting their existing general. So Pathon gathered his troops and went to Babylon, joining forces for Seleucus in anticipation of conflict with Eumenes. When spring came, Eumenes took his army east, intending to establish a base camp along the northern Tigris before heading south to seize the royal treasury at Susa, now home to much of the wealth plundered from Persepolis during Alexander's conquest. Along the way, Eumenes discovered that Assyria was in a rough state. Mostly ignored by the new Macedonian government, the northern half of Mesopotamia had never really recovered from Alexander the Great's crossing before the Battle of Gaugamela. First, tens of thousands of Macedonian soldiers had freely plundered the region on their way east, and for most of the intervening half-decade, banditry had run rampant, while infrastructure was ignored. There quite simply wasn't enough food to support Eumenes' 30,000 troops and their thousands of camp followers. When Eumenes started gathering boats and crossed the Tigris into more bountiful territory, Seleucus and Pathon sailed up from Babylon with two triremes and dozens of smaller ships from the fleet Alexander had constructed for his unrealized invasion of Arabia. Initially, they came under a banner of truce and tried to persuade Antigonus and the other officers to mutiny against Eumenes. This tactic had worked for them in the last war, so it was worth a shot. However, Antigonus refused, and Seleucus took some of his men to a dry canal nearby to reconnect the old waterway to the river, suddenly flooding all of the land around Eumenes' camp. It's not quite the Nile, but prior to modern hydroelectric dams, the Tigris and Euphrates did flood when spring rains came. With this canal open, Seleucus was threatening to just wait for flash flooding to drown Eumenes and his army. So they went back to the western bank of the river. Seleucus didn't like this plan either, because the one thing he wanted less than Eumenes alive was a hungry and hostile army marching around in his satrapy. So, Seleucus allowed Eumenes to cross again, unhindered, and continue towards Susa. But as soon as Eumenes was gone, the satrap of Babylon sent a letter to Antigonus, offering to join the Antigonid and or pro-Cassander side of the war. As soon as they were through the Zagros Mountains, Eumenes started sending couriers bearing letters signed with their king's names, summoning the upper satraps to join him at Susa with their armies in order to fight Antigonus. The couriers were very surprised to discover that most of the armies of the east were already on their way, completely unprompted. It turns out, Pathon and Seleucus had formed a pact almost immediately after Seleucus arrived in Babylon, in order to overthrow the legally appointed satrap of Parthia, and install Pathon's own brother. This scared the other eastern governors and turned them against the new Median-Babylonian alliance. So they were already planning to assemble at Susa for a war before Eumenes even crossed the Euphrates. And once everyone arrived, they immediately argued about who amongst them should command the united host. Eumenes had a royal writ to command the Anatolian troops, but only them. Antigonus commanded the largest number of Macedonians. Peucestus, the Macedonian satrap of Persis, who had saved Alexander the Great's life, arrived from his palace near Persepolis, dressed in Persian noble fashion with 10,000 Persian archers, the largest single contingent in the army, with all the presentation of the recently fallen Achaemenid kings. Eudamus had come from India with 20 war elephants, the largest elephant corps in their force. So Eumenes suggested that none of them should have sole command, and instead they would make decisions as a group, in the portable tent temple, tabernacle, I guess, dedicated to the divine Alexander, as if the Lord of all Asia was still with them. However, any decision about ultimate command would be mostly for show and prestige, since, in reality, only Eumenes had permission to access the royal treasury at Susa, and was therefore in control of the army's finances. When word of all of this reached Antigonus, he slowed down on his march through northern Mesopotamia and started recruiting more soldiers from the beleaguered towns and cities of Assyria before heading south to Babylon, joining forces with Seleucus and Pathon. Both sides held their positions for the winter, but in spring of 316 BCE, it was time to get the war moving again. Eumenes and the eastern armies started marching west right away, but they got nervous and had Peucestus summon another 10,000 archers from Persia. So they encamped while waiting for the Persians to catch up along the Karun River. Antigonus started sending troops up the Copertes River, the modern River Dez. These were seen by Eumenes' scouts, and an advanced guard was sent to intercept the Antigonid army. Not expecting an attack, the Antigonid troops were caught up in a series of skirmishes before being pushed back across the river. In the haste and confusion, many of their boats capsized, drowning everyone on board. Antigonus realized that crossing the swamps and rivers between Babylon and Susa would be too difficult. So he and Pathon went north, to Greater Media, Pathon's territory. Their plan was to take the long way and reach Eumenes by going through the mountains. However, the royal road would take too long, so they had to march along a narrow mountain path and fight a running skirmish against the tribal Kosaian people. Pathon commanded the rearguard, Antigonus had the center, and an old friend suddenly reappears in command of their vanguard. Apparently, at some point after Alexander the Great's death, Nearchus, the Macedonian admiral and explorer, fell into Antigonus's orbit and became the military tutor for Demetrius, the one-eyed Strategos' son, And he just suddenly shows up in the historical record for the first time in years to fight these Kosaians, and will then disappear again for another couple of episodes. By the time the army reached Media, there were threats of mutiny, but Antigonus managed to keep a lid on it and had Pathon summon as many additional cavalry and archers as the satrapy could spare. Afraid that Antigonus would now just go around them and start plundering the upper satrapies, Eumenes' army moved back to Persis, giving themselves a more direct route to Media along the royal road. Interestingly, Diodorus tells us that Peucestes still made his capital at Persepolis. It's really hard to know what to make of that, since the main palace complex was very famously burned to the ground by Alexander. We know that there were many outlying palaces for Peucestes to occupy, but not which one. It could have been one of the large Achaemenid structures in Persepolis South, quite literally in the shadow of Xerxes' ruined home. But it could equally have been at or near Stacere, a military outpost that would become increasingly important in the coming centuries. Regardless of exact location, Peucestes treated his guests to a lavish feast in the Perso-Macedonian style, pioneered by Alexander. Of course, this wasn't just out of the goodness of the satrap's heart. He was trying to sway the other generals into electing him the overall commander. In response to all of this, Eumenes tried to regain control by sending his own loyal cavalry to raid the Arachosian baggage train. The satrap of Arachosia was a friend of Peucestes, and the raid was meant to show that backing the satrap of Persis would be treated as treason against, gods only know, Eumenes, I guess? Maybe the divine Alexander? The point was just to send a very threatening message. While Eumenes was embroiled with administrative disputes, Pathon and Antigonus were on the march, forcing Eumenes and company to march north and meet them if they didn't want to be caught by an army of Median cavalry on the completely open plains of Persis. The two armies reached one another on the border between Persis and Greater Media, in an administrative district called Paraitakene, roughly the modern Bakhtiari province. Their scouts actually ran into one another, but neither opted to skirmish without orders, and both armies encamped just 500 meters from one another for 4 days as the assembled satraps and generals on both sides tried to form a plan. In that time, Antigonus once again tried to get Eumenes' officers to mutiny with no luck, and defectors from both sides started crossing to the opposing camp. By the 5th day, Antigonus started considering a relocation. His army was running low on supplies, but they weren't too far from Gabene, one of the secondary tier of old Achaemenid palaces near modern Isfahan, and the royal complex had plenty of food and fodder available for whichever army could seize it first. Defectors then told Eumenes about this plan, and he decided to try and outrace Antigonus. So both armies mobilized. Eumenes got a head start, and Antigonus had to chase them down. This forced Eumenes to halt his retreat and turn to fight. Eumenes and the upper satraps were slightly outnumbered, but the distribution of troops in either army was heavily skewed. Antigonus's phalanx numbered 28,000 to Eumenes' 17,000. But Eumenes also had the silver shields and the hippaspists, including many experienced veteran warriors of Alexander's campaigns. Antigonus had a relatively small corps of archers, slingers, and other light infantry at just 5,500. Compare that to Eumenes' 18,000 thanks to the traditional tactics of eastern Iran. Antigonus and Pathon had gathered over 10,000 horsemen. Eumenes had just 6,300. But where Antigonus had 65 war elephants, Eumenes had 125 of the lumbering giants. They both followed the typical Macedonian battle plan. Phalanx in the middle, Hetairoi cavalry on the right, light infantry and cavalry, backed up by elephants on the left, the highest commanding officer in charge of the heavy cavalry. Except they both did this. So rather than similar forces facing off, they both aimed their lancer cavalry at the mixture of elephants, archers, and javelin-throwing horsemen. And neither Eumenes nor Antigonus could embrace their inner Alexander and hunt one another down on the battlefield. They were on completely opposite ends of the line. Though, given Eumenes' last experience with that in the Battle of the Hellespont, this detail may have been intentional. Both sides also mimicked Indian tactics by deploying more elephants in front of their formation to act as a screen for the phalanx. Pathon was stationed opposite Eumenes, in command of the median light cavalry that significantly outnumbered Eumenes and his companions. Antigonus did order Pathon to hold back and wait for their Hetairoi to initiate the battle. Instead, Pathon embraced his personal spirit of Alexander and ordered a charge, hoping to overwhelm Eumenes with sheer numbers. As the satrap of Media went across the battlefield, a single rider from Eumenes' side raced around the back of their phalanx, over to the far flank to get Eumenes' light forces and elephant fighters, who charged diagonally across the battlefield and slammed into Pathon's interior flank. When the elephants reached them, it was over. Simply outnumbering Pathon's own war beasts, they trampled horses and forced Pathon to break away, fleeing into the surrounding foothills, with a herd of angry pachyderms chasing after him. As the light cavalry pushed out of the battlefield, Eumenes' phalanx went forward. Despite numerical superiority, the Antigonid infantry no longer had Pathon to protect their flank, and they were facing significantly more experienced opponents. The Antigonids broke into a retreat. In a last-ditch effort to recover the battle, Antigonus led his cavalry into Eumenes' now exposed infantry flank and rode through the enemy phalanx, riding into battle alongside his own son, the 20-year-old Demetrius. This rallied the Antigonid phalanx, who turned around to hold their position, and the battle carried on into the night. Exhausted and fearing that some element of the Antigonid army would eventually break away to attack their baggage train, Eumenes ordered a withdrawal. But when Antigonus had his men count the dead, he did not get good news. Technically, Antigonus won. He had the battlefield in his possession. They were the last ones standing. But the Antigonids lost 3,700 men, and Eumenes only 540. Injuries were even worse. Antigonus was down by almost 4,000 injured troops, and Eumenes only suffered 1,000. The Antigonids withdrew into Greater Media to recover their strength and find more supplies, which allowed Eumenes to march on Gebene unopposed. Both sides spent the winter in these new bases of operations, and although I am certain that Antigonus spent the entire time furious with Pathon, it was still Pathon's satrapy, and the satrap remained in command of the Median troops. When spring of 315 BCE came, they marched on Gabene themselves, stocking up on supplies before they left so the Antigonid army could cross inhospitable desert and reach the palace city much faster. But not fast enough that Eumenes wasn't able to plan for the attack. And we will discuss those plans after a quick break. Believe it or not, language learning doesn't have to be difficult. You can learn naturally and speak confidently. Rosetta Stone helps you absorb a language the same way you learned your first one, through real-world context and conversation, not memorization. Practical skills you can use right away. The no memorization thing is a big plus to me. I've never been the type of person to pick up language through flipping over flashcards. Rosetta Stone is the trusted language expert with 30 years of experience, millions of users, and 25 languages offered as the go-to language learning solution. There's no English translations. You just learn to speak, listen, and think in the language you're trying to learn. It's a more intuitive learning process, starting with words, building to phrases, and progressing to sentences. Plus, if you're like me and you're trying to learn a language that uses sounds you're not used to, the built-in True Accent speech recognition feature provides real-time feedback to help you improve those pronunciations. You can also learn anytime and anywhere with a mobile app or on your desktop. And of course, as always, it is an incredible value. You can learn for life with a lifetime membership that gives you access to all 25 languages, so you can learn as many as you want, whenever you want. Don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential now. History of Persia listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off today. Don't miss out. Go to rosettastone.com/today and start learning today. Early in the campaign season for 315, Antigonus Monophthalmos arrived at Gabene with his army, hoping to defeat Eumenes the traitor once and for all. Rather than just going with the default Macedonian formation, Eumenes waited for Antigonus to get into position. Once again, the strategos of Asia used the standard, placing himself on the right wing with his son, and Pathon in command of the left with the light cavalry. Eumenes had made sure to mirror it this time, making sure that he and his heavy cavalry were opposite Antigonus. Antigonus and some of the silver shields rode across the battlefield to mock and call the Antigonid soldiers traitors and weaklings. Morale plummeted, and when the silver shields got back to their position in the phalanx, Eumenes gave the order to attack. The elephants charged in first. He had actually lost about 10 of the great monsters in the previous battle, but there were still a few dozen more on the Eumenes side than the Antigonids. And the elephant charge acted as a screen for Eumenes to lead his cavalry right behind the bigger animals. Antigonus had also learned from their previous encounter. As soon as combat began, the Median light cavalry and a crew of mercenary hoplites were sent from the battlefield to go far behind enemy lines and seize the baggage train, along with any camp followers as hostages. While the raiders went away, Antigonus brought the full force of his own Hetairoi horsemen straight into Paeocestus and the Persian light cavalry. The satrap of Persis decided that he didn't like Eumenes enough to die, and rode away with all of his men. Pathon had a detachment of Hetairoi too, and they charged the Silver Shields, trying to disrupt the Veteran Corps and at least score a morale victory. Antigones ordered his men to withdraw, rather than be gored by horsemen. And he went to track down Peucestis so he could blame the satrap of Persis for losing the battle before fighting was even over. With major elements of his army fleeing, Eumenes was once again forced to withdraw and figure out where all of his men had gone in the countryside outside of Gabene. It was a brutal and pyrrhic victory for Antigonus on the battlefield. He lost another 5,000 men in the carnage, while Eumenes only lost about 300. But Antigonus had the baggage train, including all of the money, possessions, wives, and families of many Silver Shields and Eumenes officers, as well as most of the satraps accompanying him. That was the breaking point in the war. Not a decisive battlefield victory, but an effective raid. Seizing hostages. The eastern satraps were tired and wanted to go home to secure their own territories. The Silver Shields and the Macedonian officers wanted to get their families and treasure back. So Antigones, the Indian satrap Eudemus, and a Silver Shield officer named Teutamus all mutinied. They arrested Eumenes of Cardia and surrendered to Antigonus Monophthalmos. Antigonus claimed that he didn't want to carry out a summary execution before bringing his foe back to Cassander in chains. However, he also didn't provide Eumenes with any food for 3 days while deliberating with the assembled satraps, so you can be the judge of his intention there. For what it's worth, though, everyone else, according to Diodorus and Plutarch, just wanted Eumenes dead. And that is ultimately what they did. He was executed, then given a proper funeral, and his ashes were placed in a silver urn to return to his family in Macedon. Despite their aid in the mutiny plot, Antigones and Eudamus were not so lucky. As leader of the Silver Shields, who, according to Antigonus, had joined the most honored Macedonian soldiers to a traitorous cause, Antigones was tortured to death. So was Eudamus, primarily because he and Antigonus despised one another on a personal basis. Teutamus wasn't much better off. He was sent east with 1,000 of the Silver Shields most likely to revolt, in order to fight in a border clash between Ericosia and some sort of rising Indian threat. More on that in a few episodes. The satrap of Ericosia was given explicit orders to treat Teutamus and his men as expendable. Peucestis was far, far too prominent to just execute. And he had always been on good terms with Antigonus when they fought under Alexander the Great. However, Peucestis had backed Eumenes and repeatedly demonstrated his personal ambition. So, Antigonus stripped him of his office as satrap of Persis, passing that responsibility off to a minor Antigonid officer instead. Peucestis became part general, part advisor, and part political hostage as a member of Antigonus's personal entourage. The one-eyed general spent that winter in Persia and received word that Cassander had achieved victory in Greece, officially bringing the war to a close. But you know, Antigonus was kind of on a roll here. He was governing from the old Achaemenid capitals. Most of the upper satrapies had pledged their allegiance to him. Officially, he was still the supreme military authority in the east. Pathon and Seleucus were really the only remaining prominent Macedonians anywhere nearby. So Antigonus summoned Pathon to come south and meet with him at Susa, where Antigonus had just installed a local Elamite friend as satrap, despite officially being satrap of Susiana himself. When Pathon arrived, he was arrested and executed too. Antigonus then installed, you guessed it, another loyal but mostly powerless officer as satrap of Greater Media. Then it was off to Babylon to meet with Seleucus. And of course, they had to go back to Macedon. So the entire Antigonid army marched with him. Seleucus played the gracious host until Antigonus started getting a little nosy. He wanted to review the satrapy's finances. Seleucus said no, and correctly pointed out that as equal satraps, Antigonus had no authority to do that sort of public audit. They started to argue more and more as the days wore on, and Seleucus realized there was no winning this. The local Babylonian militia couldn't hope to stand against Antigonus's whole army, and Seleucus knew what Antigonus was up to. So the satrap of Babylonia abandoned his province and fled with a small entourage of friends and family, clear across Mesopotamia, down the Mediterranean coast, and into Egypt, where Seleucus asked Ptolemy for sanctuary. He also reported what Antigonus was doing in the east. Even then, while Seleucus had his first meetings with Ptolemy in Memphis, Antigonus was already on the march, officially just checking in with local officials across northern Mesopotamia. But Seleucus's report was dire. Antigonus removed every single prominent Macedonian noble from power across the old Persian Empire, focusing especially on those who had personal ties to Alexander the Great, focusing on the people with the influence to oppose Antigonus. He was doing tax audits for whole provinces and appointing new satraps without any kind of royal permission. It sure seemed like Antigonus was acting as a king. So, Ptolemy and Seleucus dispatched messengers north, warning Cassander in Macedon and Lysimachus in Thrace that even as they read the letters, Antigonus Monophthalmos had seized control of most of the former Persian Empire, and he was on the warpath. Barely a few months after the second war of the Diadochoi finished, the third had already begun. But that will come next time. Until then, if you want more information about this podcast, you can go to historyofpersiapodcast.com. That's where you'll find things like maps, my bibliography, and the financial support page. If you just want to hear more of my voice, check out my other podcast, America Secret Wars. That's where I tell my guests about all of the forgotten and overlooked wars in American history. And if you want to support these projects or my work in general, you can head to hopfulmedia.com.co to donate, buy merchandise, or subscribe and get access to both shows with no ads, bonus episodes, Discord access, and more. No money, no problem. The absolute best way to support indie podcasts is to recommend the show to others and leave a review. Until next time, thank you all for listening to The History of Persia.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East, the very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history, and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conqueror's Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.